So good evening, everyone. First time I ever heard about the ox herding stories or pictures was when Rodney, the founding teacher here, when Rodney Smith did a talk on them some years ago. Oh my God, I fell in love with them. But I think he did them over a year. I can't remember how long he did it over. But the stories and the pictures seem so confusing to me and so difficult to understand. I didn't really get to enjoy them at the time for what it is that I think they point to. And so I'm hoping that I can articulate these stories in a way, pictures that Tim and I can articulate these pictures in a way that you really get the benefit of what these 10 pictures are. I'm going to describe them in just a minute here. But to get a good sense of what it is that we are embarking on, I think this is the perfect time to practice with the ox herding pictures, because we have been spending the last, I think, since Tim and I started being the guiding teacher, we have practiced with content of the Dhamma, the Four Noble Truths and the 10 Paramis and Hindrances, 7 Factors of Awakening, all of that, even Dependent Origination. All of that is content about the Buddha's teachings. But and even to some extent, last year's topic on Dhamma and in everyday life, it was in the realm of the content of how the Buddha handled everyday life situations. And it was a little bit more practice driven than the other ones, but still it had a lot of content about it. And the 10 factors though, they are mostly practice. They are practice driven pictures, and the pictures come together to form a kind of story. And so sometimes you will hear it as ox herding stories, and sometimes you will hear it as ox herding pictures. It's the pictures that, when you take the 10 together, they begin to develop this story of understanding. And that's what we're going to work on over the course of the year. So a little bit about these stories. I figured tonight I would basically do a basic, summary or kind of overview about it. And then we'll have a discussion night in the next week. And as part of this overview, I want to put it in the context of how we practice, because what we are going to look at is a very common Zen practice. It's very common in Zen, Zendos and centers to practice the ox herding stories, pictures, whatever. It's a very, very much a part of the way they practice and understand the unfolding. It is the basic unfolding of awakening. And so in the Theravadin tradition, we have a similar kind of unfolding called the stages of awakening. And those stages were put together by Mahasi Sayadaw, who is a Burmese monk, and a lot of us follow that tradition. And so from that line, there's still the stages of awakening. And I think every tradition has some kind of a way to see how the practice is unfolding within you. And the ox herding stories are what they teach in Zen to help their practitioners understand the unfolding of this Dhamma. So I think, well, there are many different versions of the ox herding pictures, many different versions. And so it's very difficult to kind of pinpoint what are the pictures that exist. I'm trying to pull together the pictures that I like and use those pictures as there's a set of pictures that I like out of a I think it's Tricycle did an article on it, and I like those pictures because they seem more connected to me as a non-Zen practitioner. But nonetheless, there are very different pictures, and they're not always 10. Some of the stories were only 5 pictures, and some were 8. I think they came from, they came from a teacher in China. So I read a couple of things. So one thing is that they came, the teacher that I'm thinking of, he came out of the 12th century. So I'm not sure if the 600 AD is around the 12th century. I think it's not quite the 12th century. It's a little earlier. So a little earlier than that, there's a story about a teacher who sees one of his monks, and he asked him, what is he doing? And the monk says, I'm herding ox. This is kind of the first kind of connection to maybe what these ox herding stories are related to. But the monk says, I'm herding ox. And so the teacher asks him, well, how do you do that? He says, well, I give the ox a task, and when the ox moves away from that, then I whip it back over until it gets back in line. And then when it moves away, I whip it back together. And I just keep whipping the ox until the ox stays where on task with what it's supposed to do. And in some respects, that is what it is that the mind, that we are doing with the mind. We are not whipping the mind back in shape, but the teacher heard that's what you do with practice. There is a training of the mind towards where it should go. And this idea of training the mind becomes very, very, very important. It's a misnomer, because the mind that we are training, we don't have any control over. So we don't actually have control over the mind, and yet the whole point of our practice is to train the mind to focus in a certain way. This kind of paradox is the nature of Dhamma and why it's so difficult. It's so simple and it's so difficult at the same time. Let me see what else I want to say about the stories themselves. I've given this sort of talk in smaller chunks twice already, so it seems like I'm repeating myself, but I'm not. So the point of the pictures is to help a student who comes into the path of Dhamma to understand that there is a natural flow towards awakening. There is a natural process by which awakening unfolds. And that unfolding comes when you're on the path. the stories are to show how that unfolding happens. So in some and many respects, a lot of Zen teachers would teach this as the ultimate awakening path, from a beginning practitioner all the way to you're a stream entry or beyond that. Stream entry meaning that you have opened the Dhamma eye, is what it's called. It means that you see the Dhamma more clearly, and you're not so much caught up in your own, in the mind's kind of habitual selfing way of seeing the world. You see the world through the understanding of right view. And that is considered like stream entry, and your understanding changes. But the path itself can be seen as that whole 10 stories, how you're going. And I think in some respects, Rodney may have taught about it like that. I don't know. I can't remember how he taught it. But I was new to the practice when he did the stories, and I did not have the same capacity to understand everything he was saying. I loved the stories, but then I would get lost in some of the talks. So when I started actually practicing with the stories and the pictures themselves, instead of me using them as my framing for my ultimate awakening, I used them as the framing for how close I was to awakening in any given moment. Meaning, in the midst of some difficult tension, some problem I think I have, could I see where I was in this 10 stories? Could I see where I was in that? Was I at the very beginning trying to figure out how the Dhamma even applies to this situation? Or am I closer to understanding the union between me and this so-called problem I have? That's what these stories point to. So I want to talk about them over the course of the time I have, and I'm pretty sure Tim was going to do the same. We want to talk about them both in its application to a present moment experience and its application to the larger path of awakening, ultimate awakening. Now, this is Zen practice. It's not Theravada. And I was telling, I don't know who, maybe Sunday morning. I can't remember. Anyway, I was telling one of the groups I was talking to earlier this week that Norman Fisher used to come to Sims, and he would tell jokes. And Norman Fisher is a Zen master, right? He would tell these jokes. And he would say the joke, and the room would be silent. Everybody would be sitting there. And then he would say, oh yeah, that's right. You guys are Theravadin. And he would give us the punchline, and then everybody would crack up, because we'd all understand what he was talking about. When he first told the joke, we couldn't get it. And then with Theravadin, because of the way that we practice differently than Zen. And that's one thing you have to understand. And Zen practice is very, as I'd say, it's more like you ask, what is the Four Noble Truths? And a Zen teacher would say, go check it out and see for yourself and come back and tell me. So they're not really going to tell you what the Four Noble Truths are. You're going to go check it out. And whatever you come up with, you're going to come back and say, this is what I think the Four Noble Truths are. They're like, go check some more. Go keep looking some more. So it's like when you ask, what is Zen? They're going to say, go find out. You go tell me what Zen is. They're not going to tell you what Zen is. But Theravadin is a little different Theravadin, we say, this is the Dhamma. You go check it out and see for yourself. See if that rings true for you. So there's more of a kind of foreshadowing that you get from Theravadin than you do in Zen. It's a little different. So I'm saying that it's a very broad stroke here. That's just my opinion. But I'm saying that because these pictures come with a little verse and then a commentary about the verse. And for many of us, you won't understand the verse and you won't understand the commentary that's supposed to explain the verse. That is the difficulty Tim and I have, is to somehow or another put a framing around that verse and a framing around the commentary in such a way that we understand how it applies to us in our practice and how we could use that to support us in the practice. So, you know, we talked about it. We're game for it. We want to do it. So I think we can open it up in such a way that we can begin to see how this applies. There's a couple more framings I want to give. A way to think about these pictures, and I'm not going to actually talk about the pictures until the end of the month, because it'll be closer to the start of February when we start the first picture. So I'm going to talk about them in the last 2 months. But for this week and next week, I really want to talk about the framework on how we actually enter into looking at these pictures, because that has a lot to do with, I think, how we begin to understand what we're entering into. So one way to think about the pictures is to think about it from the context of child development. I don't know if you guys have kids or you know anything about child development, but everybody knows that 2-year-olds are referred to as the terrible twos. You know, there's sort of like a kind of a universal knowing. Everybody kind of knows teenagers have their own problems. They're like a little difficult. So we kind of have this framing of understanding that in certain stages and certain ages with children, there is a way in which they are behaving that's very much in line with their age. And the more you know the developmental stages of the ages of children, the more you understand what's actually happening in that stage, because you know where they're at. And you don't take it personal and you don't get caught up in reactivity with them. You may have a problem with them, but you understand the nature of where they're at. And that understanding is what helps you be more gentle, kinder, and supportive to the child's growth in their own growth. But I was telling the Sunday morning sit that the first time I ever connected to the fact that adults have developmental stages also blew me away. I think I was in my late 30s and pretty much feeling like my life was over with. You know, I had totally blown it. There was nothing good was going to come of this life anymore. It's all over. And I'm almost 40, so it's over. That's it, you know. And I remember finding a book by Gail somebody, I can't remember her last name, called Passages. And if you've never read that book, that is a great book to read. I read that book and I understood, I was right where I was supposed to be in terms of developmental, adult developmental capacities in your late 30s. That there are certain things you have to let go of in your late 30s that you will in order for you to move into your life after 40. And by me reading that book, I think I saved myself many, many years of depression, because I realized where I was and I realized where I was going. And I had this whole life in front of me that I pretty much didn't realize before I read the book. I thought life ended at 30. If you didn't get, you know, if you weren't a millionaire by 30, you pretty much blew it. And so I read this book at the right time to help me see that, oh yeah, there's a lot to do. There's a lot more. That book and child development, there's a way in which we are learning how to move through the world, how to move through life, and understanding both the challenges in the stage of where you're at, but also the complexity of the stage where you're at and the possibility of where you're going. You can see all that if you understand where you're at is a stage and not a sign of whether you're good or bad, whether you've got it or you don't got it. And when I understood that, then I understood where I was going for the rest of my life. And I let go of that sort of self-flagellation that I had totally messed up. But the totally messed up attitude or thoughts, that's pretty much within the stage I was at. That's what actually helped me, that the thinking that I had messed up was part of the challenge of being over 35. It comes with 36. It comes with 37, 38. That's where we're at. So in a way, these ox herding pictures and the stories that go with it tell us the stage we are at in our practice. And that stage comes with it certain challenges, certain complications, certain complexities, and it's moving into further development. It helps us see that this isn't the end all beat all, that there is more development to go. So I think the stories themselves, when you understand the context of what we're learning, is not so much a judgment on where you are as much as it is a kind of a framing and a foundation to help each of us begin to see how awakening unfolds. And if you look at it as the ultimate awakening, then you may find where you are along the path and you may be closer to the beginning. And you may think, damn, I should be further along because I've been practicing for 20 years. Surely I should be in the number 8 picture. Why do I feel so connected to picture number 3? And that, I think, is a judgment that is not helpful. And so a better way, I think, to approach these pictures so that I feel more connected is to look at the pictures in relation to how am I doing with this particular subject? How am I doing with this particular moment? And sometimes I feel like I'm further along in the pictures, and sometimes I feel like I'm searching and I'm in, you know, picture number 1. I'm right at the beginning trying to figure out, is it even possible to find some Dhamma to help me with this? That understanding has helped me a lot, instead of framing it as this is where I am in my practice, because it doesn't really have anything to do with years like that. It has to do with the training of the mind. So that's pretty much, let's see. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. I just wanted us to know that the pictures are the arc of practice, awakening in general. Now I want to talk about what I actually want to talk about in the framing of this between now, this week and next week. I want to develop this part a little bit more. And then we'll get into the actual pictures at the end of the month. When Buddha awoke, he was not the first person to get enlightened. It's important to understand this. This awakening that the Buddha, that happened with him, is not some, special thing that happened to a special person and not, it can't happen to me. That becomes what I think very, very, very important. Because at the time that Buddha actually awoke, he did a game changer. And I want to see if I can point out a couple of places where he did this game changing kind of thing and why it's so important to understand the stages of awakening. This is what I think. We are not doing self-help. I guess I could say it like that. We are not trying to make ourselves better people. We are not trying to, there may be some wanting of to be a better person. I don't question that part. But awakening is a different beast altogether. Awakening and where we are in this path of awakening becomes very, very, very important if you look at the framing of what it is that the Buddha did when he became enlightened. So first I want to read this quote, this little paragraph that Thanissaro Bhikkhu said about the Buddha's awakening. He said, two crucial aspects of the Buddha's awakening are the what and the how. What he awakened to, so what Buddha awakened to, and how he did it. This is what the pictures are pointing to. His awakening is special in that the two aspects came together, both what he awakened to and how he did it. He awakened to the fact that there is an undying happiness. That there is an undying happiness. That's what is referred to as the deathless. And that it can be attained through human effort. That becomes very, very important here. Through human effort, not through some special means, special family. Got to be born a Brahmin. Got to be born into royalty. Got to have blue blood, not red blood like mine is. So you got to have special. I do have special. I came from the project. So I know I didn't come from special. But I am a human, just like Buddha is a human. So human effort can attain this undying happiness. The human effort involved in this process ultimately focuses on the question of understanding the nature of human effort itself. So in terms of the skillful karma and dependent origination. So basically what he realized in his awakening was that the more we develop a skillful karma, which is skillful actions, and understand the co-arising nature of both action and wisdom or ignorance, that when we understand that, the path to awakening is all kind of laid out in itself. It's not something that we have to fight for on our own behalf. it comes. It's part of the package. So if you take a step back and you think, and you kind of, I just want to tell you the framing in which the Buddha's understanding of that, these two things coming together, that there is undying happiness and that it can be attained through human effort. That was not the thinking at the time of Buddha's awakening. So the common thinking at the time of Buddha's awakening was two extremes. One extreme was it's predetermined. That is the underlying kind of way that caste as a system works. It's also how caste works in this country. It's how caste works everywhere. There's kind of like an underlying determination that if you come from poverty, you stay in poverty. It's predetermined. If you come from money, you stay in money. And the money people keep money, and the poor people stay poor. And that kind of systematic way in which we tend to accept the life we have been given and just accept this is my plight in this kind of predetermined understanding. Many religions, many theories, philosophies and philosophers base their whole understanding on this notion of predetermination, so that things are predetermined. And what you're trying to do is basically be as good as you can. Your actions matter in that you be as good as you can, so that when you die, God will like you anyway, even in your poverty, or in a caste system, you maybe will be able to come back as a better caste in the future. So there's always this, your actions matter, but it's already determined once you're born. On the other extreme was this idea that the world was chaotic and random. It's just a mess. You don't have any control over nothing. Nothing's predetermined. It's all a mess. And all you can do is tuck yourself into your own little world and do what's right and move your way through this chaotic, massive, troubled world. That's the thinking that existed when the Buddha got enlightened. We still have that thinking here, you know, in our world. There was sort of the thinking, and people would take the thinking of that time and they would narrow it down to a practice that helps you move through the world as best you can in this thinking. So your progression through the world is based on whether you believed predetermination or you believed in the mass chaos. But your actions had nothing to do with the predetermined rules that you live under or the mass chaos. It just kind of protected you as a being. That's the closest I think. That would be my take on the way I think the world was when Buddha got enlightened. So then Buddha comes along and realized, no, there is undying happiness and human effort can get us to it. It's choice. It's your own choice and effort on the path. This becomes important because what we are going to practice over the course of the year is a kind of understanding, a paradox between individual choice in any given moment and stages on the path of awakening. that we are at that's very much cultivated and seen for what it is. Are you with me so far? Okay, a little bit more. I'm going to give you the basic theories that the four ways that Buddha boxed this in so that we could actually cultivate the effort to awaken in the midst of this paradox, where awakening unfolds gradually through stages, and yet each one of us have a choice, a choice, a choice, a choice. And that choice is what I think Buddha's awakening points to. So if this is another little, I read a lot of Thanissaro Bhikkhu's stuff because I love it. So here's another thing he said. He said, awakening itself is not preordained. No one is doomed to never awaken. At the same time, neither is awakening assured. So even if you move your way along the path and you're up in the pictures around 8 and 9, awakening itself is not assured. It's contingent on intentional actions chosen in each present moment. So in each moment, there's this choice, and that you're constantly faced with choices that will either speed up your final awakening or slow it down. So you move through the stages. That is very much identifiable, and you can begin to see where you're at, know where you're at on the location. Like, I can see a street sign of Everett, and I know how close I am to the Canadian border. We can see these different aspects. I can tell, I told Sunday, on my 5-year-old granddaughter is very different than she was when she was 4. I can't believe it. It's just a few months. When she was 4, she was kind of inquisitive. Now that she's 5, even the way she talks to me is more like telling me what's going on, telling me about myself, telling me about stuff. She's very definitive about what she knows because she's more self-aware now than she was when she was younger. And the more self-aware she becomes, the more definitive she is in her knowing. It's just a strange phenomena to see that as a Dhamma practitioner. When I had my own kids, yeah, some of that stuff she says they would have never got away with. They would have been like in total trouble. So, but now I have more wisdom, more understanding. Anyway, so you're constantly faced with choices that will speed up final awakening or slow it down. Nibbana, this awakening, of course, is independent and unconditional. But the act of awakening to Nibbana depends on a path of practice that has to be willed. You see the dichotomy here that we're faced with, both this independent, unconditioned thing that can happen, and at the same time, we want to have intentional, willed action towards this path. It happens only if you choose to give rise to its causes. And this is what the Buddha noted. It involves determining to do 4 things: not to neglect discernment, to preserve truth, to develop relinquishment, and to train for peace. So those 4 things we're going to talk about even more next week. I'm going to give you the basic framing of it, and then next week we're going to go into more depth about it, because those 4 things, I think, is what we frame holding this dichotomy of learning about stages along the path and not getting so caught up in the stages without recognizing our own choice to keep moving along, to move through those stages. Whether you're in one or you're in five or you're in eight, you may be at any stage, but you're constantly moving along, moving along, moving along in this intentional way. So, first one, this kind of building discernment. This idea of building discernment comes from, I would say, four main framings of the Buddha. The fact that the Buddha realized skills can be developed, that awakening can occur from human effort. So our actions mean something. Whatever you do, what I'm pointing to is, if I have a freak out moment with my son, that action means something on my path to awakening. I don't want to put a damper on it and make it be like all heavy, like, oh my God, I can't move from this spot because I may slow things down. But the more you begin to realize that actions matter and what we do matter. It matters not just the me apologizing to Raymond, but it matters how we move through the practice. How I move through the practice means that I have to pay attention to how I act when I get reactive. I still get reactive, but I'm going to pay attention to how that unfolded and what happens. I'm not going to let a reactivity just go unnoticed. That doesn't happen with me anymore. I'm going to find out why, what happened. So he pointed to, you build discernment by understanding skills can be developed. And one way to work with the pictures is to begin to see how skillful is certain behavior. Beginning to care more about the skillful nature of what you're doing than whether you're doing something good or bad. Is it skillful? Is this going to support me along the way? And not, then what do I need to know about this behavior that's going to help me build this skillful actions? So action itself is not illusory, like it's predetermined, so who the hell cares about your actions? Or it's chaos and random, who the hell cares about your actions? No, action is not an illusion. It's skillful or unskillful, and we need to learn to discern what's skillful and what's unskillful. Part of the capacity to learn to see what's skillful and what's not skillful is this wise attention. And developing wise attention as a participant or observer. And another way to build discernment is wise intention, knowing, or right intention, knowing the motivation behind what you're doing. These are the kind of the factors that build discernment. And in each stage, there are things to look out for to help you pay attention to what stage, what picture you're in, what process along these 10 stages you're at. And you can begin to see and develop the wisdom to identify where you're at. And as you develop where you're at, you develop discernment on how to move through that stage and not get caught in some of the challenges of each one of the stages. So that's one thing, this building, not to neglect discernment. And we're going to talk more about these next week, but I just want to give you the kind of the framing of what we're going to talk about. I mean, I know next week is summary, so it'll be a summary of this, and we're going to talk more about these. So the second one is to preserve truth. And what I think of with this idea of preserving truth is that you begin to realize that truth comes from seeing things as they truly are, comes from seeing the truth of something, and knowing what is true and what is not. So part of the knowing of what is true and what is not, part of the seeing of truth comes from seeing that the mind can make stuff up, completely fabricate the whole moment that you're in, and learning to see the fabrication of mind is part of this learning to discern truth, this beginning to preserve what is true so that you know that you're not moving through the world following a mind that is making it up as you go. You're moving through the world following a mind that can perceive truth, but it can also perceive a fabrication. And you learn how to distinguish when is it perceiving fabrication and when is it perceiving truth. I have a lot of examples of this, but the only one I'm going to touch on for a moment is my relationship with fear. So I came from trauma. Many of you know that. A lot of trauma. And I didn't have a correct capacity to see the truth of danger and safety. I never could tell whether I was in safety or danger. And oftentimes, what I thought was completely safe was seriously dangerous. And what I thought was dangerous was nothing. It was all jacked up. It was just all messed up. I had to learn to perceive the truth of safety, or another way you could say, the fabrication of danger, so that I could begin to see when I was following the mind's fabrication and when I was preserving the way things truly were, and when I could see that. Part of each one of these stages, each one of these pictures, is beginning to see what is inherent in the stage and what is kind of like making it up. The mind's just making up stuff, and it doesn't have anything to do with practice itself. So gradually we're going to begin to see the truth of each one of these pictures. And there's no special I'll do the last two here, but I want to stop here on this truth thing. There's no special way that you have to perceive it. There's no special way. I mean, Tim and I teach very differently. So it isn't a matter of, oh, I got to hear the way Tim teaches, because Tim can be a little bit more clear. That I'm a little nebulous sometimes in the way I talk. So I say things, it feels like, that sounds interesting. I don't know what the hell she's talking about. It sounds interesting, but I don't know what that is. And Tim has a way. I've just listened to his talk. I just so love it because it's so methodically clear. And at the end, I feel like, oh, I understand. So it's not, oh, I have to listen to Tim so I understand, or listen to Tori so I don't. The whole point of the path is to, the whole point of this year, I'm setting the framework so that we cultivate discernment and we cultivate truth and we cultivate, the other two is relinquishment and training for peace. We cultivate these kind of capacities within each one for ourselves. Not I tell you or Tim tells you, but that we basically inspire you to want to look at that picture, practice with that picture, do the homework with that picture, so I can see for myself as a practitioner. and see if I can see and understand what this picture is saying. That's what's going to help you ultimately know where you are. So the last two is relinquishment. It's understanding the quote I gave you from Ajahn Lee. The mind is not good or bad. The nature of being human is not good or bad. If the mind or the nature of being human were basically bad, you wouldn't believe you could awaken. There would be this sense of, I'm just too bad. I mean, that's when I worked in prison, that was the hardest thing, was that people who were sentenced to prison, in the prison, they now think, well, I'm basically bad. So there's no way I can do anything of good. And the reason why religion is so supportive in prisons, whether it's Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, what all the religions that go into prison, the reason why it's so helpful is because there's this huge push against that idea that I'm basically bad. So even if you are in prison doing a life sentence, like the guys, those three guys that just got sentenced to life and life with and life without, at some point when they get in the prison, they have to come to a point that they could still get on the path towards awakening, and that it's not your mind. You are not basically bad because we do bad actions. You have to account for the karma of your actions. But even in prison, you can cultivate kindness, goodwill, and shift your entire karma relationship and path. At the same time, to believe this idea that we have that people are basically good. If you feel like people are basically good, or the mind is basically good, you can get stuck in complacency. You can get stuck in this kind of, oh, it's gonna be good anyway. I mean, basically, it's all gonna work out. No, there's an earnestness that we have to put forth in order for the undying happiness to be revealed. It will not come just because I can wait it out and over time, eventually, lifetime after lifetime. In Buddhist time, people believed a lot in India in reincarnation. So, you know, basically, if you're basically good, just keep working in and eventually you're going to work your way out of this whole cycle. And the Buddha came along and said, no, that cycle is going to go on for eons and eons and eons, and you will never get out of it unless you intentionally move your energy towards this building discernment, truthfulness, and relinquishment. And then the last one is training for peace. It's points to something that Philip says all the time. You're practicing practice, not practicing results. We're actually practicing to be on the path. We are not practicing to be awakened, but we are practicing to be on the path of awakening. And so there's a huge level of desire that can support us. But in this kind of practice itself, we got to appreciate the practice itself. So that means when we're practicing in the midst of some difficulty, we're not trying to, I mean, there is an aspect of trying to make things better. That you're not giving that up. But you're also very much in gratitude and appreciation for the opportunity to practice with this. The first time I had this understanding was around anger, because I had so much anger from so many years of abuse and so much drama that by the time I came to Rodney with the anger, usually I just tried to practice to subdue that anger so I didn't mess up and hurt somebody. But when the anger got more out of control than I could control it, that's when I went to Rodney to try to help me figure out how do I get this anger back under control like I had it? Because it's out of control right now. I'm afraid I'm going to end up in jail or lose my job or worse. And he, you know, I'm not going to go through a lot about what he taught me, but the point that he helped me see is that until I actually befriended anger, actually appreciated when anger arose so that I could actually practice with it, I would forever be running away from something that I couldn't control. And when I started befriending it, then I would be able to understand the nature of it, and it would not control me. So that's what I want to talk about. I'll, you know, talk a little bit more next week, but I want to leave you with a little story. It's a little, another Zen story that, I shared on Sunday, but I think this is a lot about what we are talking about. The ox in the ox herding story, sometimes it's referred to as the mind, and sometimes it's referred to as awakening itself. And so I want to share this story and leave you with this. This talk actually took way longer than I thought it would, so I appreciate you spending the time with me. I didn't expect it to be this long. But so there was a Zen monk and his monks, a teacher and his monk. They were all walking into this marketplace, and they saw a man who had a rope around a cow, and he was yanking on the cow, the rope, to get the cow to come and let's go. And the cow wouldn't budge. And he's pulling and pulling and yanking, and the cow is not going. And so the teacher, the main monk, he asked the other monks, the senior monk asked the other monks, who is in control here? Who's the master? Who's the slave? Who has the control? The man pulling the rope or the cow? And the junior monks, all the monks said, well, the cow is the servant, is the slave. And the man with the rope, he's the master. He's the one in control. He's the one that's got the rope. And so the monk cut the rope, and the cow took off running the other direction. And the man realized his cow is running that way and ran after his cow. So then the monk asked, okay, who has control here? It's like, rethink it. That's it. That's the whole story. And I think in practicing with these pictures, we want to know how much we can't control the mind, but we can set in motion the conditions that control or support right effort. That's what I think we are looking at. Not control the mind, but how do I support right action, right effort? And that's what I think we're going to work on over the course of this year, which I think is beautiful. So let's take a moment, sit quietly. Give you my quotes again. Actually, I just do Ajahn Lee's. That's the one I really think is important here. The mind is neither good nor evil, but it's what knows good and knows evil. It's what does good and does evil. And it's what lets go of evil, lets go of good, and lets go of evil. Thank you so much. I appreciate your patience with me and sitting here with this whole talk. I've given too many retreat talks, so they can go an hour. But I don't know. I just think this subject is so important, and we have the possibility of really growing together. I appreciate you spending the time with me and giving me a little extra time. I don't know that we have time for questions, and so I really don't think that we should have questions now, actually. I think I'll talk a little bit more about this, these four building blocks, and kind of next week, and then we'll have a discussion, and we'll let the questions come out of that greater discussion. But I think, really, if you just spent the week kind of contemplating just what you heard and what does it mean to you? Can you see the gift the Buddha gave us from the world, those two extremes? And his world is so different. The practice we're doing, it's so different. And so, then we'll talk about it next week. Okay, we'll do it next week. Okay, Kuba. Bye.